Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, today's the third Monday of the month, and snow or not, this is where we look at how you can improve your work life and work-life balance. The legendary Harvey McKay joins me around 12:35 today to share how to become indispensable and unbeatable. He says, pay attention because caring is contagious and profitable. And we'll look at some of Harvey's insights, or McKayisms as they're known. He's actually one of my favorite business authors and has been on the number one bestsellers list at least three times, I believe. But we'll find out more about that later. My first guest is economist Laurie Bassi, and she's written a book called Good Company, Business Success in the Worthiness Era. And Laura Bassi and her co-authors, show that despite the dispiriting headlines, we're entering a more hopeful economic age. The authors call it the worthiness era, and in it, the good guys are poised to win. So I'm looking forward to talking with Laurie and learning more about that. But first, we are going to share a couple of tips. One of the questions that I get asked the most is, what do I need to make my resume stand out from everybody else's? And of course, it's a big thing today with so many people looking for work and employers receiving so many resumes. So I'm going to ask Eric. Hi, Eric. Join us today.
Hey, good afternoon.
Well, you join us every week. But,
yes, I do.
We're going to talk about five outdated resume elements. And if you have any of these elements in your resume, then you might want to rethink it because, as I said, employers get so inundated with resumes. You know, it's like, how do I even get my resume looked at? That's the question that I get
asked. It's a good question, absolutely.
All the time. So we're going to share this with you, and it's from blog.employmentguide.com. It's written by Brandon Lawson, and I think he's done a good job here of pointing out some outdated resume elements. So let's jump on into those. Eric, you're going to read these out to us.
Sure. So number one is objective statements.
Yeah, and I think many of us have been trained to put an objective statement on the resume. I don't have one on mine. I don't know about you, but I have a summary, basically, of, you know, my key, what I can bring to the table. Mm-hmm. I don't have an objective statement. Brandon Lawson, who wrote this, says that he believes that they're a waste of space and that most employers know that they're there to fluff up your profile. So use the space more effectively and prepare a cover letter in its place. And that's really important, even when you're sending resumes by email, to put some cover letter on there, too.
So with objective statements, he means like when you say, my goal is to be a manager in your company and change
And I like the emphasis on
that. It's that sort of thing,
it's
right?
It's that kind of thing. Yeah, people will say, you know, in 5 years, I expect to be blah, blah, whatever.
Right.
I personally think they're a waste of time. And I know when I was hiring, I disregarded whatever was there because people are going to tell you what you think you want to hear.
Exactly. Okay, well, number two, apparently, outdated resume element number two is personal information.
Yeah. And I've been surprised when I've, you know, when I worked in banking, how many people would actually put their social security number on there, their date of birth, their sex. None of that is needed. In fact, it's illegal for companies to ask date of birth and sex and all that stuff anyway. So information like your address, medical history, social security number, irrelevant on your resume, leave them off. If you have a URL, a website, put that on there.
I still find people putting their hobbies on resumes, and I wonder if that's ever done anybody any good.
I would say probably leave it off.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, number three, outdated resume elements is references upon request.
Now, I don't know that I agree with Brandon on this. He says employers will usually consider this statement a given if they decide to bring you in for an interview. You know, they'll just assume that you're going to give it. Mm-hmm. So you can replace references upon request by having a list of your most recent supervisor's contact information on hand. So Well, maybe I do agree with him then, because he's not saying put it in the resume. I definitely wouldn't put it on the resume or on your cover letter. That's something you want to keep handy and have handy if you decide you'd like to work for this company and if they are interested in offering you, you know, taking you to the next level. But you certainly don't want people randomly calling supervisors or managers or colleagues you work with if you haven't made the announcement you're leaving.
Agreed. Okay, number four would be listing all positions held.
Yeah, and of course, you know, when you get to my age, it's quite a long list. But the one of the ways you can get around that is, you know, differing viewpoints on this. I've talked with HR consultants who say, you know what, when somebody's been in the workforce for a long time, then an employer expects to see a great deal of detail. But here's the thing. I would always go back to, are they going to read my resume? That's what you want them to do. And if it's 4 pages long, no, they're not. Even if it's 1 page long, sometimes I've met with people and they still haven't read the resume. So right. I'd keep it short and concise. If you've got a lot of jobs, then you might want to not do a chronological resume, but you might want to just pull out the skills and abilities and the changes and the results that you've got and package your resume that way.
Okay, so our fifth of the five outdated resume elements is jargon.
Yes. I remember when I first was consulting and I was consulting with a large software company, and I went home that first day after meeting with all these BBMs and BMBs and GGBs, and my head was spinning. And what I found was that they had many glossaries within the company, and BGM meant different things in each glossary.
Uh-huh.
So you want to assume that the HR person, if they look at your resume, doesn't understand what, you know, any of those acronyms and spell out in full what right. you're looking for.
But if you're using jargon for the industry, doesn't that show that you're knowledgeable, that you're hip, you're with it, you know what's going on when it comes to
me, it's that, rhetoric.
Industry?
It's, yeah. And but the thing is, it's not going to go straight to the person who's hiring. It's going to go to a recruiter. And often that recruiter doesn't have that specialized industry background. They're looking for, you know, background checks and and references and stuff like that. So I definitely spell it out in a resume.
Good point.
When you get there and you're talking with someone, you know, that's a whole different thing. And also one other thing that I'd add on here that's not on Brandon's piece is that remember that most resumes are not seen by the human eye. They're initially scanned by a computer, and the computer is looking for key search words. So make sure you read that job description very carefully. Pull out the keywords that they're looking for. If they say must have, make sure those must have words are in your resume. Otherwise, the computer's going to spit it out as a reject before you even get through the door.
That's one I definitely wouldn't have thought of, but it's a changing world. So that makes a lot of sense.
Very changing. All right, we're going to run and pick up our first guest now. Thanks to Brandon Lawson, 5 Outdated Resume Elements at blog.employmentguide.com. Please stay with us. We'll be talking with Laura Bassi when we come back.
In the snow, where do you go to find something you could eat? Because the word out on the street is you are starving. Let yourself go.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
It's about the third week of the year when our New Year's resolutions start to wane. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, we devote the whole hour to staying on track. We'll explore how to beat those bad habits that are hard to break and examine the gifts of patience and presence. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for program details or call Vicki at 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Click the show's page on 1150kknw.com for the scoop on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Fox in the snow. Fox in the snow.
And welcome back, everyone. In this segment, we are talking with Lori Bassi. She's an economist and expert in human capital analytics. She's the CEO of McBassi & Company and also chairs Bassi Investments, which uses the principles of the Good Company Index to manage assets. And we'll talk about what the Good Company Index is in just a moment. Lori holds a PhD in economics from Princeton University and spent the early years of her career as a tenured professor of economics at Georgetown University. She's the author of over 80 published papers, including two articles for Harvard Business Review. And she's one of the co-authors on Good Company, Business Success in the Worthiness Era. Her co-authors on this are Ed Fraunheim and Dan McMurrah with Larry Costello. Lori Bassi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know you are very invested in this book. Tell me why you think this book is going to make a difference. You talk about corporate social responsibility and taking that to the next level. Why is it going to make a difference?
Well, first of all, it contains some very good news at a time when I think people, particularly in the United States, could use it. That despite all of the dispiriting headlines of bad corporate behavior, in fact, what the book shows very clearly, and I think quite compellingly, is good companies, those that are good to their employees, good to their customers, and good to the communities and the environment in which they operate, actually make more money than the bad guys. So that's good news at a time when we need it, and I think it should be a wake-up call to large corporations that, you know, it pays to be good.
And let's just define what we mean by good a little bit, because so many companies are greenwashing their products, their services. They talk a great talk about sustainability, but you're not just talking about that. And an interesting fact I read in your work when I was researching for this was that a recent study said that as many as 98% of companies are actually greenwashing their products and services. But define good for us as in from a consumer perspective?
Well, from a consumer's perspective, so first of all, we there, there are three major pillars to being a good employer. Good company. Number one, being a good employer. Number two, being a good seller. And number three, being a good steward, where this concept of stewardship is very broadly defined. But from a customer's perspective, you know, customers care, obviously, about a fair price, quality, reliability, safety, honest communication. So those are the attributes of a good seller from the customer's perspective.
And your company created the Good Company Index. Tell us about that and how you measure.
It's a fairly bold move. We assign a grade of A to F. And in this version, we do it for the Fortune 100 because, quite frankly, it was a pretty challenging thing to figure out how to do this. Now that we've figured out how to do this, we believe in the future we'll be able to create grades for a broader and broader set of companies. But we did this all very quantitatively, objectively, transparently. It's all available. The methodology and all of the underlying data components are on the book's website, goodcompanyindex.com. So we grade the Fortune 100 A to F. Only two companies get an A, Disney and FedEx.
Yeah,
gets an A minus.
That was shocking that only two companies got a grade A.
Well, you know, it turns out there's a lot of bad behavior going on out there, Vicki, which may not be a surprise to many of your readers.
But no kidding.
Some of it was shocking to us when we compiled just how much bad stuff there is going on in these very large companies.
Well, give us an example, because we're all familiar with tainted food, tainted pet food, you know, the greenwashing thing that I just mentioned. Give us an example of what surprised you the most, maybe.
One of the things that surprised us the most, unpleasantly, was we, I think, for the first time, to our knowledge, compiled all the major fines and penalties against these firms. And, you know, we don't think we've gotten 100% of them, but we think we've gotten the big ones. And the level of, you know, either breaking the law or skirting right on the edge of breaking the law and doing so sequentially kind of as a cost of doing business among some of these firms is pretty sobering.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've actually heard people say, oh, well, it's just the cost of doing business. If we get fined, just the cost of doing business.
Yeah. Whereas we kind of started with this notion that, you know, abiding by the law is kind of a principal starting point, but apparently not all large companies agree with that.
Mm. So that's what surprised you most, and negatively, in a positive way, what surprised you most,
well,
Lori?
Well, the flip side of that is, while there's a lot of nasty behavior going on, there's also a lot of good behavior going on. And sometimes in the very same companies using their core capabilities to really solve fundamental problems for the communities in which they operate. And, you know, since many of them are big companies, these are mostly all big companies, that means solving real problems in the world, as their contribution beyond making money. So that is actually quite inspiring.
Right. So I want to look, if I can, just at let's look at Walt Disney, because that was the only company that scored an out-and-out A.
Mm-hmm.
What in particular made that company a good company on the Good Company Index?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, they get the basics right. You know, they're a pretty good employer. They do, in fact, delight their customers. And they really are a good. They get the stewardship. This is the real deal. It's not greenwashing. So they get all of those things right, and they avoid bad behaviors. So, you know, not using offshore tax havens, not excessive CEO compensation, don't have big fines and penalties racked up against them. So they do all the basic stuff right, and they avoid doing bad things.
Right. And I was talk a little bit about Walmart, because that received horrendous bashing for years in the press. But I know they've made some attempts, genuine attempts, to clean things up or whitewash.
Well, their efforts to become good environmental stewards that's the real deal. I mean, they've really gotten a religion on that. So we give them very high scores on that. Overall, we give them a grade of C, which comes as a surprise to many people because many love to hate Walmart.
Mm.
So it's not that they're getting an A, but they're not getting an F. And they really get this environmental stewardship thing. They are making major contributions to help end hunger in the United States, so they're using their core capabilities to do good. They've got a long way to come as a good employer, though.
Mm. And then let's look at a couple of the bottom 10. And these are Fortune 100 companies. And in the bottom, with a D, you've got, with an F, actually, you've got Sunoco, Valero Energy, ExxonMobil, Rite Aid, with a D. What makes them bad in particular?
Well, it's kind of the flip side of the Disney story. They are failing to do one or more of these basic things right. You know, they have less than sterling marks as a good employer, or that, you know, their customers are not overly enamored with them, and or they are doing bad things with respect to being stewards. They are not good stewards. So they're getting one or more of those basics wrong. They're not attending to them properly, and they're typically doing some quite bad things, either, you know, using a lot of offshore tax havens. Being extremely aggressive, we would say, on tax minimization, which is not, it's not consistent with being a good steward to your communities if you're aggressively avoiding any taxes, or consistent major fines and penalties against them.
Right, right. Now, the title of the book is called Good Company, Business Success in the Worthiness Era. Talk to us a little bit about that subtitle there, the Worthiness Era.
The fundamental thesis of the book is that there is a convergence of forces, economic forces, social forces, and political forces, that is actually forcing companies to become good companies in our lives, just like we'd like good companies in our homes. And it all boils down to this, Vicki. Technology-fueled people power is shifting the balance of power from large corporations to people, to us little folks. And people are using that power to fight back against bad behavior. They're punishing bad behavior, and they're rewarding good corporate behavior. And that's good news for all of us.
Mm. Let's look at a couple of examples that have been in the news over the last few months. And still British Petroleum is in the news. And they changed, I always thought British Petroleum was above board. And I always thought they were really active in searching for renewable energy sources. And that's why they changed their name to Beyond Petroleum. And I was shocked to read that less than 1.2% of company revenues actually come from alternative energy.
Yes, we would consider this an example of greenwashing. They clearly did a major rebranding, repositioning of themselves. They have that beautiful logo that elicits thoughts of nature and renewable energy. But in our view, according to the evidence we compile and share in the book, we do think it is an example of greenwashing. A lot of talk, not a lot of action. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there is their persistent safety and environmental record. The Gulf Coast disaster was certainly not the first one of those kinds of incidents that BP has had, although it is the largest.
Right, and there was some governmental responsibility there, too. You talk about that. I can't remember if it was in the blog or in the book, but you talked about that, too, that, one of the ways that we can be more assured that they're not greenwashing is to have regulatory practices in place. And even though there was a regulatory practice in place, it was basically overlooked.
Yes. Clearly there's government culpability in this as well. Economists have a notion of what's called a captive agency, a government agency that's actually been captured, albeit subtly and perhaps over time, by the very businesses that it is intended to regulate. I think we clearly have a large dose of that going on here.
Mm.
But, the flip side of that is BP was forced to essentially show live footage of this oil gushing out. That could not be hidden anymore. And so their original conservative estimates of how bad the damage was clearly revealed to be less than truthful by this live footage, which was forced upon them. This is part of the new technology-fueled people power that is causing these better outcomes to emerge.
Right. Well, talking of the technology people power, do you really think that companies are less ethical today than they were 20, 30 years ago, or is it just that we're hearing more about it now?
It's a good question, Vicki. Greed is an age-old problem. Bad, greedy behavior is nothing new. I think what's new is the scale on which it can be exercised. As markets become larger and larger, we are truly in a globalized world, the scale and the negative impact of greedy behavior has larger and larger negative impacts on all of us. So, we have to, for the goodness of all of us, we have to have some countervailing forces against the potential magnitude of this. And that is, I think, where technology-fueled people power is coming into our assistance.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about the Asian equation, as you call it, and how that's starting to change, because we've blamed, we've blamed many incidences on things are being outsourced to China, to Vietnam, to Taiwan, forgetting that we're responsible ultimately for that. But you say that whole equation is changing now, that the Chinese workers are becoming more aware and they're refusing to work in conditions that are so bad as they were, say, 5 years ago, even 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's really remarkable if you watch what's been happening over the last year to year and a half. These workers in these, you know, oppressive conditions in, for example, Chinese factories, at very low levels of formal education, but quite technologically savvy folks, have really learned how to communicate amongst themselves using social networking, using their cell phones to record and upload videos of abusive behavior. You know, they have gained some real concessions just in the last year. So we call that workforce democratization. It's one of the political forces at
right.
work, and it's fueled by an increasingly global citizen consumer, I think. You know, that's what's happening in China. Here in the United States, people are increasingly watching the social responsibility reports. You know, some bad news for Apple in the last week, that, you know, they're getting dinged in the press for what's going on in their outsourced factories in China. It doesn't matter that they're not the employer of record. They're getting held accountable in the court of public opinion for what's going on in the factories where their products are produced.
Right. And, you know, we talk about this a lot, but we have to just vote, keep voting with our money. And we do have a voice now, thanks to technology. And I was looking on your blog, and you talked about the recent debacles experienced by Netflix, Bank of America, Verizon. All tried to change. Well, Netflix tried to change its whole business policy, and Bank of America was charging fees. Verizon was trying to do the same for customers who wanted to pay online. And tell us what happened very quickly, especially with Verizon, what happened very quickly.
Well, Verizon, being very late in 2012, Change.org had itself pretty mobilized after the Bank of America debacle. And they actually, using the same kind of mobilization forces, they and others, gained so many signatures. I think Change.org had over 130,000, might have been almost 180,000 signatures against Verizon's announced $2 charge for paying your bill within 24 hours, which is just astonishing.
Yeah.
And Verizon had to back down on a policy it had announced just the day before. It revoked it in, you know, within 24 hours. Now, that's an example of technology-fueled people power.
Yes, yes. And the Change.org, I had not really, I wasn't really familiar with this until I read your work. And you say that, or this blog post says that anybody can basically sign up and launch a petition against something they want to change, like the fee situation with Verizon.
Actually, I didn't know that either until I saw the letter that the organizers sent out on this particular one. You know, isn't that astonishing to think about the power that gives the gives
yeah.
people? You or I could do that this afternoon.
Yeah, we definitely have more of a voice. Now, if we're looking for a job, if we're trying to do business with a company, if we own a company, you say we should look for inspiring purpose. We should look for the whom. We should ask the for whom question, and we should ask the for what question. I wonder if you'd talk a little about that.
Yeah, the basic point there is that to be a good employer, and we believe that is foundational, it's very hard to be a good seller for long if you're not a good employer, for example. So getting this good employer thing right is foundational, and it's not easy. So in one sentence, we would say what it means to be a good employer is to be simultaneously caring, exacting, and inspiring. Now, each one of those has to be unpacked. We could have a whole call about each one of those three elements, but inspiring. What the evidence is showing is that more and more people expect to find meaning in their work. It's not enough just to take home a paycheck. Although, you know, some people are motivated almost exclusively by money, most of us are not. Most of us want more from our work than that. So having an inspiring workplace, a place that does care, for example, for the community of which you, your employer is a part, is increasingly an element of being a good employer.
Right, right. You start the book with a story about Home Fed. I wonder if you'd share that story with us.
Home Depot?
Oh, Home Depot.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm looking at Federal Express here. Yeah, Home Depot.
So Home Depot back in 2007, its customer ratings were really going down, and they, you know, had some terrible CEO problems, and their stores were getting dirty and understaffed, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, their logo is, you can do it, we can help. And they were clearly not holding up the promise that they had made to people, you know, with these dirty stores, understaffed, surly employees. And so a reporter who happened to love Home Depot posted a blog post. And within a week, there were almost 4,000 responses to his single entry, almost all of them negative. So severe was this public backlash. And now, you know, think this is almost 5 years ago. Things have gotten even much more powerful since then. That the CEO actually had to step in a very unusual way. He actually posted an apology on the blog post, on the blog. You know, none of the traditional PR spin. The CEO waded into this himself, apologized, told people what they were doing to change Home Depot, which over the years has in fact improved. So that's another example. You know, one single blog entry that tapped into some fundamental truth and unleashed this human venting, which caused change.
And I think a lot of CEOs have learned the hard way that they can't ignore social media.
Absolutely.
It's not going to go away. And if people complain on there, somebody needs to address that and address it quickly.
Absolutely. I don't know if you have time for one more quick story.
Yes.
This is a personal story. You know, I run a small business, and normally I have no trouble getting paid by our clients. But I had this one client who just was not paying us and was rudely not responding to phone calls or emails. So I turned the matter over to my husband, who's an attorney. And, you know, usually one phone call from the lawyer or one email takes care of this. They wouldn't respond to him either. He got a little annoyed by this. So he tweeted out, and this was several years ago again, you know, before things were as powerful as they are now. He tweeted out, why is the XYZ company, I shall leave them nameless, why does anybody know why XYZ company is not paying its bills in a timely manner? And within 2 minutes, the phone rang.
Oh, my gosh. That did get quick results.
Right, because they were monitoring this. They can't have that kind of negative PR.
Right.
And this is a single 140-line tweet from a, you know, somebody like you or like me.
Right, right. Well, I appreciate you being with us today. Some really great and very interesting information in this book. It's called Good Company, Business Success in the Worthiness Era. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Laurie?
Well, you know, take a look at the website. We'd, of course, love for you to read the book. We think it's a very good read. One of our co-authors is a great writer, Ed Fraunheim, a great storyteller. Good analysis, and it will give you hope, and it will make you smile.
Great. Thank you so much.
And thanks for having me, Vicki.
Yeah, and we can find that website at, remind me of the website.
GoodCompanyIndex.com.
There we go. GoodCompanyIndex.com. Thank you, Laurie Bassi. And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll be joined by the legendary Harvey McKay. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Thanks, Laurie.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicki at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're going to be talking in this segment with the legendary Harvey McKay. He has a brand new book out called The McKay MBA of Selling in the Real World. But to me, this book and the tips and the inspiration and the wisdom in here apply to life in general. Harvey McKay is the author of 6 New York Times bestsellers. I believe this also just joined the New York Times bestsellers list. So that would make that 7, including Swim with the Sharks, Without Being Alive. His books have sold more than 10 million copies worldwide, translated into 42 languages, distributed in 80 countries. And he's also a nationally syndicated columnist for United Features. He's been doing that for a long time. I believe he's got a syndication of over 100 papers there. Harvey McKay has also been named one of the top 5 speakers in the world by Toastmasters International. And if you've ever been to Toastmasters, you know they take that very seriously. He's also the chairman of McKay Mitchell Envelope Company, a $100 million company that he founded at the age of 26. I want to welcome Harvey McKay to the show. Welcome.
Vicky, hi. Happy New Year, and thank you for those kind words.
And Happy New Year to you, too. I said to you right quickly before the show that I've read much of your work when I worked in the financial industry, and was pleased to see this new book come out. And I want to tell you, just ask you why you wanted to write this book and call it The MBA of Selling in the Real World.
Well, I kind of think it's maybe the culmination of the 6 previous books that I wrote. It's not necessarily dog-eat-dog or rat out there in the marketplace, Vicky. It's shark eat shark. And so it's a kind of defining a moment, a culmination of my work. I've been 19 years a syndicated columnist, as you mentioned, going to about 10 million newspapers every week, 100 different cities. And I really believe out there, if I can set the table, that every listener out there is a salesperson. From the moment they get up in the morning to the moment they go to bed, why do I say that? Because they're negotiating, they're communicating, they're persuading, they're influencing. And if you're not a good salesperson, whoa, let me tell you, you're being taken to the cleaners then all your life by someone that's going to influence you.
Yes.
So with that going on, the economic tsunami, the, as you know, closer to 17-18% unemployment when you take into consideration all the people looking for a job, people that have given up looking for a job, people that are working part-time. There's 5 million people out there that have been looking for more than 1 year. So I believe in order to solve those kinds of problems, it would really help to shed light, and you happen to say it, on life itself as well as, yes, it sounds like a selling book, but it's way more than that.
Oh, absolutely. And this I loved. You said, hey, I don't want you to read this book. I want you to rough it up.
Study it. Underline it. Highlight it. Use Post-it notes. Then you'll have your MBA in the real world. Our lives basically change in 2 ways. The people we meet and the books we read. So I'd say again to all the listeners out there, hey, don't just read my book if it's a self-help book you're going to pick up. But you want to read and study other people's books and pick them up every year and reread your underlining. I also should say that I love to deliver more than I promise. So, Vicky, for all your readers, if they're going to buy the book, that's all. As long as they're going to buy the book, they should go to harveymckay.com/bonus. harveymckay.com/bonus. I will mail them within 2 weeks a $12.95 marketing book, and specifically a networking book that will really help them take their game to the next level. And if they don't want me to send them the book, then they can download the book right there in a matter of seconds.
Well, there you go. There's an offer for you. Now, I know that Swim with the Sharks, Without Being Alive, and one of your other books, Beware the Naked Man Who Offers You His Shirt, were both New York Times bestsellers, number one. And they're included on the Times list of the top 15 inspirational books of all time. And but I want to share just a little bit of your philosophy on the life, because you might think from the title "Swim with the Sharks" that you know you come at this from a very cutthroat approach. But you have one of the things I know that you've said more than once is that caring is contagious. So you're not coming at this from a totally cutthroat perspective. Your philosophy on life.
You're right. You mentioned you picked out a very important sentence among 70,000 words in a book, and specifically I write and believe and have practiced caring is contagious. Help spread it around. I've got a $100 million company here in Minneapolis where I'm calling from. Always wanted to be an entrepreneur. Still have trouble spelling the word. That's exactly what I wanted to be. And Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive did sell 5 million copies. 24 years later, still selling 250,000 a year. Incidentally, money back guarantee, Vicki, on the back page of this book, the MBA book, and going back 24 years ago, I had a two-week fight, World War III, to be the first author to ever say in a book, money back guarantee if you don't like the book.
Oh, wow.
5 million copies sold. 18 people so far have asked for their money back. 7 of them were my best friends.
Right.
So
well, that's difficult.
To get to your point about the caring is contagious, though, Swim with the Sharks in all my writings is how to be successful without being a shark. That's kind of the underlying gist and theme. And I have a page that if you said, Harvey, give me one page in the new book, the KMBA of Selling, one page that's all we've got time for, mm-hmm. then I would say the following, okay? And I want to talk about reciprocity. It's reciprocity without keeping score. Okay, that's what's very important. I want to repeat this. I believe you should use reciprocity without keeping score. Now, that means I meet you all of a sudden. Vicki St. Clair, Harvey McKay, how are you? Right to my brain bank, I say to myself, and every new person I've ever met the last 40 years, what can I do for Vicki? Now here's the key. Expect nothing in return.
Mm-hmm.
If all of your listeners can practice that in 2012, their probability for happiness, their probability for success will go dramatically up.
Yes, yeah. Now, you were just 21, I read, when you came up with 66 questions that you wanted to know about 33 purchasing managers that I assume you were working with at that time. Today, all these years later, you still use those 66 questions for everybody who walks through your door. And I saw in the book how you used those questions to help people find work. So it's, again, it's not just applicable to salespeople. It's for people who are looking for work, too.
Wow, you get an A-plus in your final exam. I can't believe how substantive in-depth you are at picking out the key phrases in, again, a 70,000-word book. Yeah, I call this humanize your selling strategy. If I'm going to go call on a Fortune 500 company or a small business and I want the business, yes, I'll Google your company. Yes, I'll know everything about your industry. But more importantly, people buy from other people because of likability, because of chemistry, because of people skills. And therefore, I want to know something about the human being that I'm working with. So in the book, I talk about the invisible web. Wouldn't it be beautiful if, well, I can. I do it on every call today. If I'm making a call on a human being, on a customer, purchasing agent, manager, I can find out through the invisible web whether he or she is a Democrat, Republican, if they're a golfer, what their golf scores are, what their handicap is, where they play their golf, where they live, the home that they live in. I can find out the money they've given, the charities, nonprofits, all of these things I can find out. And it's not immoral. It's not unethical because it's out there in the marketplace.
Right.
So if I'm going in and know 10, 20, 30 things about a human being, about a person that I'm going to try to sell to, what happens again? My odds jump way up that I'm going to do business with you.
Right.
Now, looking for a job, if you're the HR person, Vicki, when I come in there, sure, I have to know about the company, but I want to know everything about you before I walk in there. Because whenever you're selling a product, whenever you're selling a product, whenever you're looking for a job, you can't just talk about that product the whole 10, 20, 30 minutes. You're talking about other things, other interests that you may have.
Right, right. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I want to just expand on that a little. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicki at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we are talking with Harvey McKay in this segment. His new book is called The McKay MBA of Selling in the Real World. And, of course, Harvey is the author of the New York Times number one bestseller, Swim with the Sharks, which is still being sold in great numbers today, many years later. Harvey, I wanted to talk a little bit about your philosophy on life in general. I read that your philosophy is you want to be a good husband, a good father, a good business person, and to give back to your community. And I know volunteerism is very important to you. Talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Surely. Well, someone asked me on my book tour, just completed a 30-city book tour, what do you want on your tombstone? And I thought about this many months before, and I said, he couldn't sleep fast enough. I mean, I don't want to go to sleep. I'm afraid I'll miss something. I was born excited. So when I get up in the morning, the volunteerism has changed my life. And while I hope all your listeners really listen carefully to these next 30 seconds, volunteerism has changed my life. My father, national syndicated columnist, head of the Associated Press, got a hold of me age 21, said 30% of your life is going to be devoted to volunteerism. So I've sat on 20 boards. What do I do when I sit on these boards of trustees and directors? Salvation Army, United Way, Orchestra, Guthrie Theater, and on and on and on. What do? I'm raising money because all nonprofits, especially today, have trouble. Now, when I'm raising money, what am I doing? I'm becoming a better communicator, a better salesperson, a better manager, a better leader. I'm building my network at that organization. But here's the most important philosophy. I feel good about myself. Mm. And when you're out of work, if you're one of those 5 million that have been looking for more than a year, or one of those 12 million that have been out of work, then just remember, go volunteer. Go do something with passion, all right? And you will increase, again, the odds of getting what you want, finding that job through volunteerism, believe it or not.
Right, right. And I know many people have got really great jobs, actually, indirectly through a volunteer project. But one of the things I really liked of your work, I had a CD version of this, was Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty, and because I know you're huge on networking and you're all about relationships and sincere relationships. So talk to us a little bit about your philosophy around that Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty, if you would.
The subtitle of that book is The Only Networking Book You'll Ever Need, Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty. And keep in mind now, if the people are going to buy the MBA book, they're going to get a version of that Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty.
Right, right.
I believe if you could get 100 men and women, successful men and women leaders in their communities across America, interview them one at a time, what's the single most coffee. You can go anywhere in the country with a phone call and all of a sudden be greeted by friends. You can help people get what they want. And again, my father taught me this at age 21. Networking, 70% of all jobs are found through networking, all kinds of opportunities. And I don't mean going to a Chamber of Commerce meeting and exchanging calling cards. I mean having a deep down burning desire. Every person you meet, as long as you live, you want to find out about them. You want to see if you can help them. That's what a real networker does.
Right.
In the long run, again, not only economic advances, but happiness.
Yeah.
I think those are the two. I have never yet met a successful person, again, that hasn't had to overcome either a little or a lot of adversity in his or her life. And the best way to overcome that, then, is to have a network to fall back on, what I call my kitchen cabinet of friends, okay, to help me through my throes.
Right, and those are people that that might be business advisors or just friends that, to help you keep moving forward?
Counselors, friends, everybody, absolutely. I call it a kitchen cabinet. I think this is over and above the networking within your network.
Right.
Everyone should have a kitchen cabinet. That's 3, 4, 5, 6 trusted, in quotes, trusted friends care about you, that when you do have a problem, there's a lot of lumps, a lot of bumps, a lot of throttling up, a lot of throttling down in life.
Yeah.
And when you have those problems and you can absolutely fall back with great advice from some of those people from different walks of life, that's a way to solve problems.
Right. We're almost at the end of our segment, unfortunately. But before we go, I want to talk about, you are very well known for time management and timekeeping. And one of the things, and I think this is such a simple concept, but it's so brilliant at the same time. You don't actually just, you know, learn people's business hours, whether you're looking for a job, whether you're trying to sell to somebody, whether you're just, you know, trying to build a relationship, network relationship. You actually find out their habits. Why do you find out their habits?
Well, that's, again, first let me just say that we all start out in life with one thing in common, Vicki. We all have the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's just a matter of what we do with it. So first, the best time tip I can tell anyone, don't play telephone tag. Don't ever leave your message, hi, call Vicki St. Clair. Call Vicki St. Clair between 2:30 and 3:15 a.m. or p.m. or whatever. Be specific, then you won't play telephone tag the rest of your life. That's very important. I want to know what turns back to your question on habits. Everyone I meet through substantive, in-depth, again, listening skills, I want to develop my ear cue, not my IQ, my ear cue. And great listeners will find out what turns human beings /customers on, clients on. I want to know the habits that turn people on, and it doesn't matter who or where or what. I've visited 100 countries. I can find out within minutes sometimes, okay, what everybody loves to do, and that's what you want to talk about.
Right.
You know, people, when you become passionate, you're passionate about something, what do? When you have passion, you speak with conviction, you act with authority, you present with zeal. No substitute for passion, and that's what you want to find out, what everybody's passionate about through their hobbies.
Right.
And
of course, you also, as you point out, get to know where they're going to be, when they're going to be, and can connect with them more easily. We're right at the end of our segment, Harvey, and I want to make sure people have your website so they can connect with you. And I want to tell listeners, too, you've got some great resources up there.
Yes, well, it's just harveymackay.com. They can go there, but if they want that extra book, they can just go to harveymackay.com/bonus, and they can download that networking book, which you call Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty. It's the gist of what's inside that book is inside the book they'll get.
Okay, so great.
They
great.
Can download it, or I'll mail it to them, as long as they are going to buy the book, the
thank
MBA
you.
Book.
Thank you so much. HarveyMackay.com is where you can find that information. The book is called The McKay MBA of Selling in the Real World. This is a great book. And I, as Harvey requested, I'm going to rough it up. It's going to stay right by my desk with post-its and highlighter and all that good stuff. We have to run. Thanks for being with us. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for listening in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.